Hello, I'm FNH, and this is the Cthulhu Podcast. This podcast, home on the web, is at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Welcome to this, the 39th of the Cthulhu Podcast. Today, as well as getting over the end of a cold, I'm going to continue reading from the next part of Teddy Roosevelt's book, Through the Brazilian Wilderness. Then we'll have a musical interlude, and finally, we'll go to part 13 of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 8. Our trip was not intended as a hunting trip, but as a scientific expedition. Before starting on the trip itself, while travelling in the Argentine, I received certain pieces of first-hand information concerning the natural history of the jaguar, and of the cougar, and of the puma, which are worth recording. The facts about the jaguar are not new in a sense of casting new light on its character, although they are interesting. But the facts about the behaviour of the puma in one district of Patagonia are of great interest, because they give an entirely new side of its life history. There was travelling with me at the time Dr. Francisco P. Marino, of Buenos Aires. Dr. Marino is at the present day a member of the National Board of Education of Argentine, a man who has worked in every way for the benefit of his country, perhaps especially for the benefit of the children. So that when he was first introduced to me, it was as the Jacob Reels of the Argentine, for they know my deep affectionate intimacy with Jacob Reels. He is also an eminent man of science, who has done admirable work as a geologist and a geographer. At one period in connection with his duties as a boundary commissioner on the survey between Chile and Argentine, he worked for years in Patagonia. It was he who made the extraordinary discovery in a Patagonian cave of the still fresh fragments of skin and other remains of the Mylodon, the apparent horse known as the Onophidium, the huge South American tiger, and the Macrauchenia, all of them extinct animals. This discovery showed that some of the strange representatives of the giant South American plesiostone fauna had lasted down to within a comparatively few thousand years, down to the time when man, substantially as the Spaniards found him, flourished on this continent. Incidentally, the discovery tended to show that this fauna had lasted much later in South America than was the case with the corresponding faunas in other parts of the world, and therefore it tended to disprove the claims advanced by Dr. Amaghino for the extreme age, geologically, of this fauna, and for the extreme antiquity of man on the American continent. One day, Dr. Marino handed me a copy of The Outlook, containing my account of a cougar hunt in Arizona, saying that he noticed that I had very little faith in cougars attacking men, although I had explicitly stated that such attacks sometimes occurred. I told him, yes, that I had found that the cougar was practically harmless to man, the undoubtedly authentic instances of attacks on men being so exceptional that they could in practice be wholly disregarded. Thereupon Dr. Marino showed me a scar on his face, and told me that he had himself been attacked and badly mauled by a puma, which was undoubtedly trying to prey on him, that is, which had started on a career as a man-eater. This was to me most interesting. I had often met men who knew other men, who had seen other men who had said that they had been attacked by pumas. But this was the first time I had ever come across a man himself who had been attacked. Dr. Marino, as I have said, is not only an eminent citizen, but an eminent scientific man, and his account of what occurred is unquestionably a scientifically accurate statement of the facts. I give it exactly as the doctor told it, paraphrasing a letter he sent to me, and including one or two answers to questions I put to him. The doctor, by the way, stated to me that he had known Mr. Hudson, the author of The Naturalist on the Plata, and that the latter knew nothing whatever of pumas from personal experience, and had accepted as facts utterly wild fables. Undoubtedly, said the doctor, the puma in South America, like the puma in North America, is, as a general rule, a cowardly animal which not only never attacks man, but rarely makes any efficient defence when attacked. The Indian and white hunters have no fear of it in most parts of the country, and its harmlessness to man is proverbial. But there is one particular spot in southern Patagonia where cougars, to the doctor's own personal knowledge, have for years been dangerous foes of man. This curious local change in habit, by the way, is nothing unprecedented as regards wild animals. In portions of its range, as I am informed by Mr. Lord Smith, the Asiatic tiger can hardly be forced to fight man, and never preys on him, while throughout most of its range it is a most wild, dangerous beast, and often turns man-eater. So there are waters in which the sharks are habitual man-eaters, and others where they never touch men. And there are rivers and lakes where crocodiles or caimans are very dangerous, and others where they are practically harmless. I have myself seen this in Africa. In March 1877, Dr. Marino, with a party of men working on the Boundary Commission, and with a number of Patagonian horse Indians, were encamped for some weeks beside Lake Viedma, which had not before been visited by white men for a century, and which was rarely visited even by Indians. One morning, just before sunrise, he left his camp by the south shore of the lake to make a topographical sketch of the lake. He was unarmed, but carried a prismatic compass in a leather case with a strap. It was cold, and he wrapped his poncho of guanaco hide round his neck and head. He had walked a few hundred yards when a puma, a female, sprang on him from behind and knocked him down. As she sprang on him, she tried to seize his neck with one paw, striking him on the shoulder with the other. She lacerated his mouth and also his back, but tumbled over with him, and in the scruffle they separated before she could bite him. He sprang to his feet, and as he said, was forced to think quickly. She had recovered herself, and sat on her haunches like a cat, looking at him, and then crouched to spring again. Whereupon he whipped off his poncho, and as she sprang at him, he opened it, and at the same moment hit her head with the prismatic compass in its case, which he held by the strap. She struck the poncho, and was evidently puzzled by it, for turning, she slunk off to one side under a bush, and then proceeded to try to get round behind him. He faced her, keeping his eyes upon her, and backed off. She followed him for 300 or 400 yards, at least twice she came up to attack him, but each time he opened his poncho and yelled, and at the last moment she shrank back. She continually, however, tried by taking advantage of the cover to sneak up to one side or behind to attack him. Finally, he got near camp, and she abandoned the pursuit, and went into a small patch of bushes. He raised the alarm, and an Indian rode up and set fire to the bushes from the windward side. When the cougar broke from the bushes, the Indian rode after her, and threw his bolas, which twisted around her hind legs, and while she was struggling to free herself, he brained her with his second bolas. The doctor's injuries were rather painful, but not serious. The music for today is by Whispering Jack Smith, and is called Pardon Me, Pretty Baby.
Hello, hello, hello. Why, just look who's here. Hello, hello, oh dear, you know, it seems to me that I've met you before. I know I'm right. Yes, I know it must be you, because I plainly recognize those eyes of blue. But if I'm mistaken, honey, please don't get sore. Pardon me, pretty baby. Is it yes, is it no, or is it maybe? Pardon me, pretty baby. Don't I look familiar to you? Ah, come on and let's get acquainted. You know, there's a bench in the park newly painted. It's a great idea, honey, ain't it? Well, at least it's something to do. Now, was it summer when I met you? And was it underneath the moon? Or was it London? Were we gouty? How could you forget so soon? And by the way, how's your mother? And your dad and your sis and your brother? Pardon me, who's another? Well, I thought I looked familiar to you. Pardon me, pretty baby. Is it yes? Is it no? Is it maybe? Pardon me, pretty baby. Don't I look familiar to you? On my word, we're having lovely weather. And I can see that we're birds of a feather. And we should get together. That is, if there's nothing better to do. Now, you must remember Monte Carlo, where we kissed and kissed again, you know. Oh, I'm mistaken, and you don't travel. Well, it must have been two others then. Goodness sakes, look, why, it's raining. And I could go for some home entertaining. Pardon me? Oh, no, no explaining. But don't I look familiar to you? And another thing. You know, dear, we should get clubby. Oh, you're so nice, so sweet, and so chubby. What's that? You have a hubby. Well, that's all right, cause I'm married.
And now for today's main feature. Maureen O'Brien continues to read
The Dream Quest of Unknown Cutoff by H.P. Lovecraft. Part 13. Presently, from the chamber's uttermost reaches, a new sound came. This, too, was a rhythmic trumpeting, but of a kind far removed from the three raucous blasts which had dissolved his goodly cohorts. In this low fanfare echoed all the wonder and melody of ethereal dream. Exotic vistas of unimagined loveliness floating from each strange chord and subtly alien cadence. Odors of incense came to match the golden notes, and overhead a great light dawned, its colors changing in cycles unknown to Earth's spectrum, and following the song of the trumpets in weird symphonic harmonies. Torches flared in the distance, and the beat of drums throbbed nearer amidst waves of tense expectancy. Out of the thinning mists and the cloud of strange incenses filed twin columns of giant black slaves with loincloths of iridescent silk. Upon their heads were strapped vast helmet-like torches of glittering metal, from which the fragrance of obscure balsams spread in fumous spirals. In their right hands were crystal wands, whose tips were carven into leering chimeras, while their left hands grasped long, thin silver trumpets, which they blew in turn. Armlets and anklets of gold they had, and between each pair of anklets stretched a golden chain that held its wearer to a sober gait. That they were true black men of Earth's dreamland was at once apparent, but it seemed less likely that their rites and costumes were holy things of our Earth. 10 feet from Carter, the columns stopped, and as they did so, each trumpet flew abruptly to its bearer's lips. Wild and ecstatic was the blast that followed, and wilder still the cry that chorused just after from dark throats somehow made shrill by strange artifice. Then, down the wide lane betwixt the two columns, a lone figure strode. A tall, slim figure with the young face of an antique pharaoh, gay with prismatic robes and crowned with a golden chent that glowed with inherent light. Close up to Carter strode that regal figure, whose proud carriage and smart features had in them the fascination of a dark god or fallen archangel, and around whose eyes there lurked the languid sparkle of capricious humor. It spoke, and in its mellow tones there rippled the wild music of Lethean streams.
"Randolph Carter," said the voice, "you have come to see the great ones whom it is unlawful for men to see. Watchers have spoken of this thing, and the other gods have grunted as they rolled and tumbled mindlessly to the sound of thin flutes in the black ultimate void where broods the daemon sultan whose name no lips dare speak aloud. When Barzai the Wise climbed Hatheg Kia to see the greater ones dance and howl above the clouds in the moonlight, he never returned. The other gods were there, and they did what was expected. Zenig of Aphorat sought to reach unknown Kadath in the cold waste, and his skull is now set in a ring on the little finger of one whom I need not name. But you, Randolph Carter, have braved all things of Earth's dreamland and burn still with the flame of quest. You came not as one curious, but as one seeking his due. Nor have you failed ever in reverence toward the mild gods of Earth. Yet have these gods kept you from the marvelous sunset city of your dreams? And wholly through their own small covetousness. For verily, they craved the weird loveliness of that which your fancy had fashioned, and vowed that henceforward no other spot should be their abode. They are gone from their castle on unknown Kadath, to dwell in your marvelous city. All through its palaces of veined marble they revel by day, and when the sun sets they go out in the perfumed gardens and watch the golden glory on temples and colonnades, arched bridges and silver-basined fountains, and wide streets with blossom-laden urns and ivory statues in gleaming rows. And when night comes, they climb tall terraces in the dew, and sit on carved benches of porphyry, scanning the stars, or lean over pale balustrades to gaze at the town's steep northward slopes, where one by one the little windows in old peaked gables shine softly out with the calm yellow light of homely candles. The gods love your marvelous city, and walk no more in the ways of the gods. They have forgotten the high places of earth, and the mountains that knew their youth. The earth has no longer any gods that are gods, and only the other ones from outer space hold sway on unremembered Kadath. Far away, in a valley of your own childhood, Randolph Carter, play the heedless great ones. You have dreamed too well, O wise arch-dreamer, for you have drawn dreams' gods away from the world of all men's visions to that which is wholly yours. Having builded out of your boyhood's small fancies a city more lovely than all the phantoms that have gone before. It is not well that Earth's gods leave their thrones for the spider to spin on, and their realm for the others to sway in the dark manner of others. Fain would the powers from outside bring chaos and horror to you, Randolph Carter, who are the cause of their upsetting. But that they know it is by you alone that the gods may be sent back to their world. In that half-waking dreamland which is yours, no power of uttermost night may pursue, and only you can send the selfish great ones, gently, out of your marvelous sunset city, back through the northern twilight, to their wonted place atop unknown Kadath in the cold waste. So, Randolph Carter, in the name of the other gods, I spare you, and charge you to seek that sunset city which is yours, and to send thence the drowsy truant gods for whom the dream world waits. Not hard to find is that rosial fever of the gods, that fanfare of supernal trumpets and clash of immortal cymbals, that mystery whose place and meaning have haunted you through the halls of waking and the gulfs of dreaming, and tormented you with hints of vanished memory and the pain of lost things awesome and momentous. Not hard to find is that symbol and relic of your days of wonder. For truly, it is but the stable and eternal gem wherein all that wonder sparkles, crystallized, to light your evening path. Behold, it is not over unknown seas, but back over well-known years that your quest must go. Back to the bright strange things of infancy, and the quick sun-drenched glimpses of magic that old scenes brought to wide young eyes. For know you that your gold and marble city of wonder is only the sum of what you have seen and loved in youth. It is the glory of Boston's hillside roofs and western windows aflame with sunset, of the flower-fragrant common and the great dome on the hill, and the tangle of gables and chimneys in the violet valley where the many-bridged Charles flows drowsily. These things you saw, Randolph Carter, when your nurse first wheeled you out in the springtime. And they will be the last things you will ever see with eyes of memory and of love. And there is antique Salem with its brooding years, and spectral Marblehead scaling its rocky precipices into past centuries, and the glory of Salem's towers and spires seen afar from Marblehead's pastures across the harbor against the setting sun. There is Providence, quaint and lordly on its seven hills over the blue harbor, with terraces of green leading up to steeples and citadels of living antiquity, and Newport, climbing wraith-like from its dreaming breakwater. Arkham is there, with its moss-grown gambrel roofs and the rocky rolling meadows behind it, and antediluvian Kingsport, hoary with stacked chimneys and deserted quays and overhanging gables, and the marvel of high cliffs and the milky misted ocean with tolling buoys beyond. Cool vales in Concord, cobbled lands in Portsmouth, twilight bends of rustic New Hampshire roads where giant elms half-hide white farmhouse walls and creaking well-sweeps. Gloucester's salt wharves, and Truro's windy willows. Vistas of distant steepled towns and hills beyond hills along the north shores. Hushed stony slopes and low-ivied cottages in the lee of huge boulders in Rhode Island's back country. Scent of the sea and fragrance of the fields, spell of the dark woods and joy of the orchards and gardens at dawn. These, Randolph Carter, are your city, for they are yourself. New England bore you, and into your soul she poured a liquid loveliness which cannot die. This loveliness, molded, crystallized, and polished by years of memory and dreaming, is your terraced wonder of elusive sunsets. And to find that marble parapet with curious urns and carven rail, and descend at last these endless balustraded steps to the city of broad squares and prismatic fountains, you need only to turn back to the thoughts and visions of your wistful boyhood. Look, through that window shine the stars of eternal night. Even now they are shining above the scenes you have known and cherished, drinking of their charm, that they may shine more lovely over the gardens of dream. There is Antares. He is winking at this moment over the roofs of Tremont Street, and you could see him from your window on Beacon Hill. Out beyond those stars yawn the gulfs from whence my mindless masters have sent me. Some day you too may traverse them. But if you are wise, you will beware such folly. For of those mortals who have been and returned, only one preserves a mind unshattered by the pounding, clawing horrors of the void. Terrors and blasphemies gnaw at one another for space, and there is more evil in the lesser ones than in the greater. Even as you know, from the deeds of those who sought to deliver you into my hands, whilst I myself harbored no wish to shatter you, and would indeed have helped you hither long ago, had I not been elsewhere busy, and certain that you would yourself find the way. Shun, then, the outer hells, and stick to the calm, lovely things of your youth. Seek out your marvelous city, and drive thence the recreant great ones, sending them back, gently, to those scenes which are of their own youth, and which wait uneasy for their return. Easier even than the way of dim memory is the way I will prepare for you. See, there comes hither a monstrous Shantak, led by a slave, who for your peace of mind had best keep invisible. Mount and be ready. There, Yogash the Black will help you on the scaly horror. Steer for that brightest star just south of the zenith. It is Vega, and in 2 hours it will be just above the terrace of your sunset city. Steer for it only till you hear a far-off singing in the high ether. Higher than that lurks madness, so rein your Shantak when the first note lures. Look then back to earth, and you will see shining the deathless altar flame of Iradna from the sacred roof of a temple. That temple is in your desiderate sunset city, so steer for it before you heed the singing and are lost. When you draw nigh the city, steer for the same high parapet whence of old you scanned the outspread glory, prodding the Shantak till he cry aloud. That cry the great ones will hear and know as they sit on their perfumed terraces, and there will come upon them such a homesickness that all of your city's wonders will not console them for the absence of Kadath's grim castle and the chant of eternal stars that crowns it. Then must you land amongst them with the Shantak, and let them see and touch that noisome and hypocephalic bird. Meanwhile, discoursing to them of unknown Kadath, which you will so lately have left, and telling them how its boundless halls are lovely and unlighted, where of old they used to leap and revel in supernal radiance. And the Shantak will talk to them in the manner of Shantaks, but it will have no powers of persuasion beyond the recalling of elder days. Over and over must you speak to the wandering great ones of their home and youth, till at last they will weep and ask to be shown the returning path they have forgotten. Thereat can you loose the waiting Shantak, sending him skyward with the homing cry of his kind, hearing which the great ones will prance and jump with antique mirth, and forthwith stride after the loathly bird in the fashion of gods, through the deep gulfs of heaven, to Kadath's familiar towers and domes. Then will the marvelous sunset city be yours to cherish and inhabit for ever, and once more will earth's gods rule the dreams of men from their accustomed seat. Go now. The casement is open, and the stars await outside. Already your Shantak wheezes and titters with impatience. Steer for Vega through the night, but turn when the singing sounds. Forget not this warning, lest horrors unthinkable suck you into the gulf of shrieking and ululant madness. Remember the other gods. They are great and mindless and terrible, and lurk in the outer voids. They are good gods to shun. Hey! Ashantanai! You are off. Send back Earth's gods to their haunts on unknown Kadath, and pray to all space that you may never meet me in my thousand other forms. Farewell, Randolph Carter, and beware, for I am Nyarlathotep, the Crawling Chaos. And Randolph Carter, gasping and dizzy on his hideous Shantak, shot screamingly into space toward the cold blue glare of Boreal Vega, looking but once behind him at the clustered and chaotic turrets of the Onyx Nightmare, wherein still glowed the lone lurid light of that window above the air and the clouds of Earth's dreamland. End of part 13.
Thank you, Maureen. That's all for today. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk